Hi, thank you for joining us for another session of Dedication. Fans, remember the Bay City Rollers, hosted by Bay City Rollers Fan Events. I'm Suze, and co-hosting, as always, is the lovely Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Suze. Good to hear from you.
You too. You too, always. This week, we are really thrilled to be talking with the one and only Jake Duncan. Jake has traveled the world extensively in the capacity of roadie, sound tech, tour manager, event manager, and tour director with legendary acts like Jethro Tull, Aerosmith, Greg Lake, Ozzy Osbourne, George Michael, George Harrison, and even Pavarotti. He's done it all and he's seen it all. But he's with us here today to tell us about his time when he was working with the Bay City Rollers, first as their roadie and then again as their tour manager. This is probably going to be a two-parter, so we're going to start with part one, which is the roadie years from 73 to 75. So hold on to your tartan scarves, friends. Here we go. Hi, Jake.
Hi, ladies. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this.
I think we have a lot to get to, so should we dive right in?
Fire away.
All right. So now you started with them in 73. So that was really the beginning of everything as far as, you know, when they really took off. Was Nobby still in the band when you came?
Yes, he was. The lineup at that point was Nobby, Eric Faulkner, John Devine, and of course, Alan and Derek.
Oh, wow. Okay. So what was happening at that time? So you were at the end of Nobby, the beginning of Les, I guess.
I was still there when Nobby was there. When I came along, I think it was maybe April, May 73 that I showed up, because they had released, obviously they'd done Keep On Dancing in 71, the old Jameson song.
Right.
But they were spinning off the back of a song called Manana that I think had been placed at a music festival or event called the Rose of Luxembourg. Oh. So that had enabled them to buy a slightly bigger truck for their equipment and for them to be able to travel in a car on their own. And of course, at that point, they thought that success would continue. I'm trying to remember. I think after, between Keep On Dancing and Manana, I think there was a song called We Can Make Music. Mm-hmm. Does that ring a bell?
It does.
Yes.
Do I have the chronology right there?
I think so. I mean, we didn't know that in America until afterwards. So I think that does sound familiar.
Okay, so I had been playing in a local band myself, but I started playing drums far too late. It just came about because I was in the hospitality trade. I was a trainee manager in a hotel. I ran a disco there on this Friday and Saturday evening and a Sunday, three nights. And on a Sunday, they had a live band. And about 6 months into that residency, the drummer was so drunk he couldn't take his position in the band. So having sat behind record decks for, you know, the best part of 6 or 7 months and having what I've believed to be a decent sense of rhythm, I said to the guys, you know what, I think I can do this. If you give me an hour to practice, I think I can get my way through this for you. So I gave it a shot and actually it worked out okay. And they said, right, you can join the band. The other guy's not joining the band. So, but then I started to ignore my great blossoming hotel management career and saw the neon signs of rock and roll and spent too much time with the band. And then it must have been a Thursday evening in Edinburgh. I went into the music store to buy some drumsticks. And the Rollers had two of their own roadies, two local guys. But the main guy was in the shop buying guitar strings for Eric Faulkner and didn't seem in a very good mood. And of course, because he was a local guy, I sort of knew who he was. And he announced to me that his other guy who helped him had just quit. And this was Thursday. And on Friday or Saturday, they had a gig in a place called Bournemouth on the south coast of England, in a place called the Chelsea Village. Now, things hadn't really been going well in my own band. My lads were getting tanked up every weekend, and the only reason we got away with it is because our audience were more tanked up than what we were. And I just thought, somebody once said, a man only makes three you know, meaningful decisions in his life. And at that point, I just thought, you know what? And I said to him, look, what if I came with you? And he said, what, you'd come with me? Like, we're leaving, like, in about 3 or 4 hours, you'd have to go with me. And I went, yeah, I want to do it. Now, my band had a gig the next night. So there was some wanted posters stuck up around Edinburgh for a good few weeks.
Oh, no.
But, you know,
well,
something just said to me, if you don't do this now, you'll never. I mean, I can't credit myself with, I mean, what was it, 20, 21? I can't credit myself with enough smarts to know that that was a good move at the time. But something just did it, and bang, you know, I left 4 hours later, and we drove all the way from Edinburgh to Bournemouth.
Wow, that's amazing. Meant to be.
Little did you know that was going to be a life-changing decision.
No, I didn't. I mean, I was just too young. I mean, I wanted to get ahead in the business, but I could see something told me. And again, where such insight came from at such an early age, I cannot recall for the life of me. But something just told me that here was a chance. I mean, they were a local band, but they had quite a name. Although they'd been going since 65, you know,
Keep
Up and Dance, they'd got into the charts. They'd done well off the back of that. So they were a successful local band.
Yeah. There's a lot of buzz about them. So time, Nobby's still the lead singer. Take us through the transition of Nobby leaving and then Les coming on board.
I don't remember much about it. I remember going with Tom Payton down to a place, funnily enough, that's not far from, I'm in a place called Dunbar in East Lothian, 23 miles sort of south-southeast of Edinburgh, right on the coast. There's a little, another coastal town not far from here called North Berwick. And Les was in a band, singing in a band, and they were playing down in North Berwick. So at that point, if I recall correctly, so this is a long time ago, there was some bad blood, definitely between Tam and Nobby.
Mm.
And I don't know whether at the time Nobby felt he could go on to do something else. There might have been something in the offing. I don't know. I mean, I'd only joined the band a few months ago, so I didn't really get too embroiled in things like that. But right. I do remember going to watch Les McEwen in his own band in this town that's about 20 minutes drive from here. I think, I don't know why Tam dragged me along there, maybe just for a second opinion or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm. And then, as I say, specific details are a bit murky now, but not now, because the original recording of Saturday Night had Nobby Clark's vocal on it.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
And the initial pressings of Saturday Night went out with his voice on it.
Right.
But if I'm not wrong, I don't think we ever did any promotion, any visual promotion with Nobby singing that song.
Yeah, I don't think it went anywhere in the UK, did it? I mean, of course.
It did not. Yeah. It did not, yeah. Which is incredible when we know later what happened in the US with it, you know?
Exactly. That was our beginning. So, okay, so that's 73. Remember was released as a single, but that had Les's vocals at the time, right?
Pardon me?
Remember came out in 73. Was that still Nobby singing, or was that when Les had come in?
I think definitely the early pressings of Saturday Night had Nobby on it. I think Les was on Remember from the start.
Yeah,
but
okay,
I'm not technically 100% sure. It was one of those two songs where the initial pressings, it was Nobby's voice on the vocal.
Definitely Manana and definitely Saturday Night the first time around was Nobby.
Yeah, okay. So whether or not he got it, because Remember must have been released technically late 73, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
December 73, maybe. And by, I think, I sent a little pic of my diary earlier. Did you see that 2 pages of the diary I sent where
I'll add it to the video.
Actually doing that first Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
I've left it upstairs in my office, but I feel that, I think it was early February that song went into the charts, and then it peaked at something like 5 or 6 maybe.
Wow, that's
a few
amazing.
Weeks later.
That's amazing. So at that point, did you think that, you know, Les was the ticket to that, or was it just going to happen anyway? Or did you think that, you know, that was the real start of something when he came on board as singer?
Well, there was definitely some nerves emanating from within the band. I do recall whether there was conversations would it be in the van coming back from a gig, or, but around about the time of Saturday night, it was pretty much, look, because I think, obviously, we know Keep On Dancing was first, and We Can Make Music was either second or third, and Manana was second or third. Mm-hmm. So this was their fourth single, and I think the feeling in the band was, look, this is it, you know? I mean, here we are 9 years later.
Yeah.
Oh, if this doesn't work, we're pretty stuffed here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, that might have... Now, and initially, because it didn't sell, so because Saturday Night didn't sell well here at all, Nobby might have just thought, you know what? Because, you know, Nobby could write a song or two, and at that point, he probably just thought, you know what? Time to jump ship. This is going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then... And whether or not it was a case of Les coming on board, Tam trying to impress the record company and saying, give us one more shot at this, and remember being released, and then that took off. But, you know, Nobby had put 9 years into that band.
Yeah, kind of bad timing for him, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
So he did the legwork, and then this new guy comes on, you know, hell of a voice, but
yeah,
that's too bad. It's sort of like a Pete Best story, isn't it? A little bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then 74 comes, and there's more lineup changes. Woody replaces John Devine. Do you remember how that happened? Is it kind of the same kind of a thing?
I think John also just wasn't thinking it was going to happen, because I'm pretty sure when we did Top of the Pops, remember, Woody was already in the band.
Oh, okay.
So there wasn't really much of a difference time-wise in Nobby going and then John Devine going.
Okay.
Now, ironically, John Devine came from a town called Tranent, which is 20 minutes drive in the other direction from where I am right now. And I've always thought, you know, I wonder if he's still got relations of people there, you know?
Yeah, you should try looking him up.
Yeah, well, these are all things that round to now, because there's not a whole lot else I can do, although I'm tidying up my filing from 30 years. and you know, I'm actually walking into my garden, I think, for about the 10th time in 6 years. But that I hope to find a lot, you know, once all this calms down a bit, I hope to find some more time to do these things. Because in my business, when you get to the level of international touring, once you go on tour, you know, your personal life is not your own.
Yeah.
You know, you actually, the only way your life progresses when you're on tour is age-wise or financially.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you don't progress. Anyway, I digress slightly. So
that's okay.
I was sorry to see John go. John had a good sense of humour. We had some good laughs between 73. I mean, mainly what would happen between when I first joined in early 73 through until... Well, at least for the first year, let's say, until Remember got off the ground and that, we would basically leave here, if we were lucky, I'd pick all the guys up in the van locally in Edinburgh, we'd have the equipment in the back of the van, and we had a panel between the front and the back with the two rows of seats, so the band travelled in the van. I'd pick them all up, and if we were lucky, we had a Thursday gig somewhere. We were still trading off the back of Keep On Dancing and Manana. And I'd pick the lads up and we'd drive south, maybe, I don't know, to York somewhere.
Mm.
We'd do a Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday if we were lucky, and then we'd just get in the van on the Sunday and drive back up to Scotland. Because Nobby had a licence as well, so we were fine with drivers. It was myself, the other roadie, and Nobby and Alan, I think, both had licences at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so we'd stay in cheap bed and breakfast places on, say, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and after the Sunday gig would come back up to Scotland. And that was pretty much how it went throughout 1973 and the early part of 74 until Remember broke. But having said that, and not to pardon the pun, Remember, the Rollers were already contracted to quite a lot of shows through March and April. So they were in the charts at number 5, number 6, and we were having to honour gigs that had been contracted from 6 months before.
Wow, you mean, so you mean going into 74?
Yes.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, we were in early, there was a big tour at the end of 74, but in early 74, and these contracts had what was called a chart clause in them. So let's say the promoter or the venue paid £125 a night, let's say, for the show.
Right.
And if the most bands had these clauses, if by the time they got round to doing the show and they were placed in the top 30, there was another £50 went onto the contract price.
Oh, wow. Bonus.
and if they were top 10, there was another £150.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, the whole TV thing started to happen off the back of the television.
Right.
So we had the band very quickly, not officially nurtured, that's not well. They had nurtured them a little bit. Tam did a lot of work in the early days, tirelessly sending out black and white glossy photographs of the band, because in those days, you could pick up, let's say, Teen Pop magazine, and there would be Susan there saying, oh, I like the Beastie Boys, and your address would be in there, you know,
right.
Because so you wanted a pen pal.
You could connect,
Forget all that nowadays, you know, with information, all that sort of thing. But in those days, so Tam would get the rollers down to his house and they'd sit in a dressing envelope and put these black and whites out and send them to these kids. And so there was an undercurrent of awareness. And then when it hit, especially with two new guys in the band, so suddenly we're having to go and play these small shows. 300-400 people maybe, and you know, we're in the charts.
Oh, wow.
So that's where the hysteria started, right there at these gigs.
Yeah, that wouldn't happen today, would it? They would cancel those gigs as quicker than you can say bye-bye and come to a bigger arena. Well, a lot happened in 74. They had their first TV appearance on Liftoff. Shang-a-Lang reached number 2, then Summer Love Sensation reaches number 3, Roland's released, it goes to number 1, and then All of Me, Love All of You reaches, I mean, number 4. So they're in the charts. So naturally, a tour is going to happen. So they do a big tour, UK, right, of UK?
Yeah.
Bigger venues, I'm assuming?
Towards the end of 74, yeah.
What was that like? It must have been pandemonium.
Pandemonium. So what we did was, remember, there was very few arenas in those days, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was maybe Wembley Arena, was maybe the only arena in the UK back in those days.
Yeah.
So you were playing town halls and cinemas, you know, you could, because, you know, they would just take the screen out the way and you'd have a fairly deep stage. And you'd play clubs, you know, and dance halls. You know, it was more dance halls and clubs and town halls.
Mm-hmm.
So again, these places were just not prepared for the level of hysteria that the Rollers were courting at that point. Especially on that late 74 tour.
Mm.
I mean, we upgraded the van. We got we upgraded the equipment van, but this time the boys were travelling on their own. Tam had bought an American estate car, and they were just driving around in this estate car. I mean, it was eating gas, and myself and the other crew guy, Ted, we were driving the equipment. So in a bigger vehicle. But, you know, in those days, you know, when you turned up at a club, we didn't really have a lot of equipment. We didn't need a lot of equipment. The days of the technological advances that we know now were way in the distance then.
Yeah.
So they gave us a bigger vehicle. We got a brand new Mercedes panel truck, and beautiful, brand new. We got twin tanks fitted on it for the long distances. And within about the first week, when we played the first show, one of the girls had come out and written something on the van in lipstick, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I love Woody or something, okay?
Yeah.
So, of course, we just take delivery of this van, about this truck, about to our pride and joy. So, you know, we found some acetone or something that wouldn't damage your paintwork, but we'd get the lipstick off. But then, you know, three nights later, we came out, and another four or five girls had done it. And it got to the point where we just couldn't keep up with it. There is a picture somewhere of only one, because during this downtime I've been sorting through a lot of family photographs. I'll take a snapshot of a picture, probably the only one going, that shows the state that this vehicle was in.
Oh, I would
eventually
love that.
That would be awesome. Because then they started spray painting and everything.
They were quite the vandals, my goodness.
But, you know, and I can remember coming out of, where did we, Leeds Warehouse or something, and because the girls were so desperate to get anything to do with the band, etc., we couldn't get the back door open, and discovered, thank God there was a side door on the truck, a sliding side door, because a girl had taken a pair of manicure scissors to try to force the lock on the back door of the truck, and the scissors broke, and the points of the scissors were stuck in the lock.
No.
The door open.
Oh my gosh.
So these were just regular concerts. But I have to tell you, at that point, I was making the princely sum, stand by your beds here, of £12 per week.
Whoa.
Maybe $20.
Dear, oh dear. Oh my goodness.
Now, but however, you could eat as much as the band paid for your food. Now, by the time the 74 tour came round, the bigger N74, I was probably on about £30 a week there, which is still quite a lot of money in those days, yeah?
Yeah.
But also to say that in the earlier part of 74 and the latter part of 73, it was £12 a week, but you got your food paid for, you know?
No.
So if you had to, and you got your bed and breakfast paid for, okay? So it was basically £12 and as much money as you could eat.
Nice.
But when the hysteria thing started, the way that myself and the other roadie managed to make up our wages was that because, you know, you'd have all these screaming kids in like Wolverhampton Town Hall, okay?
Right.
They're all jumping up and down, screaming, jumping up and down. Now, obviously, because I think you know what's coming here, because it didn't take too long for us to load our truck, because it was only a Mercedes panel van, okay, we didn't have a lot of equipment. Before we started de-rigging the equipment, we would run up onto the balcony and go along the rows of seats once the kids had left and pick up all these coins. Yeah?
That
fell out.
That is genius.
All the coins had fallen out of their pockets.
That's genius.
So we were getting paid £12 a week, but we were making about another £15 a week over four shows a week.
Very enterprising, Jake. Very enterprising.
And also, can I tell you, I remember coming out, when the hysteria thing hit really huge, it was a way. And it came, obviously we know it happened really bad down the years for the boys, but initially everybody saw them as a quick buck.
So
I can remember, again, there'd be pandemonium. Like once Ted and I got, once they left, the guys left in their car, the fans soon dissipated, you know?
Yeah.
And it would just be, in those days you didn't have local crew to help you load the vehicle because you didn't have a lot of equipment, so Ted and I did it ourselves. I can remember coming out the back of the vehicle and looking down and seeing what we call a rosette. I don't know if you know that expression.
Oh, we do, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, right, a rosette, okay. And I looked down, it was a picture of Eric. And I looked down and the light must have caught it. And there was two small staples. So it was a tartan rosette, okay, tartan,
right,
with Eric's picture, you know, maybe the size of a silver dollar,
mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm,
in the middle of the rosette. But I thought I saw maybe a couple of staples there. So I picked it up, and I picked the staples off, right? And Eric's picture fell off, and there was a picture of Rod Stewart behind him.
Oh, no! Poor Rod!
So some enterprising merchandiser, had an excess of Rod Stewart rosettes, okay, because of the tartan, the connection to Scotland.
Absolutely, wow.
They've just gone and got these pictures of the guys, they've cut them out about silver dollar size, and they've stapled them into the middle of a Rod Stewart rosette.
That is incredible. All right. I wonder what Rod will have to say about that. I'll have to give him a call and see.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So
sadly, on a more somber note, that was the very early stages of people taking advantage of this band financially.
Absolutely.
And you know where that eventually led, sadly.
Yes, sadly.
Yeah, that's terrible. So when this is happening at this stage, are you and the guys like just like freaking out in a good way, or are you freaking out in a bad way? Like, is it scary or is it exciting?
It's adrenaline pumping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, once you get away from the girls, you can kind of like breathe a sigh of relief and just, you know, continue on to the next town.
Yeah, I mean, we would, and now remember in those days, as I explained earlier, they've contracted a lot of shows before Remember became a hit,
right.
And they were just desperate to do whatever they could. We were doing some long distances. I mean, back in those days, I was fried, you know. I mean, hallucinating on the freeway, you know, I'm not proud of it, you know. Situations where, you know, we're playing Dundee one night, okay, which is 50 miles north of Edinburgh, okay? Mm. We're playing Plymouth the next night,
wow,
which is 450 miles south of Edinburgh. Now, okay, it's not like the tours that I'm involved with now. There's not a rigging call at 6 in the morning.
Right.
But you still had to get in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So what we had to do is load up in Dundee, and we had no choice. We'd been in Dundee all day. Say we got Dundee at 2 o'clock, set up, sound check, do the show, trying to get out, because typically, as has happened throughout my career, unless the girls see the band leaving the gig, they think the band are still in the gig. And no amount of persuasion will tell them otherwise.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yep.
So, you know, it would still be difficult when we had no one to help us load the truck. Not so much because we had a lot of equipment, just from the point of view of security. You know, you're playing a lot of these nightclubs, it's three stories up, you know, to where the stage was.
Mm.
And you've got to carry a Marshall 4x12 cabinet on your back.
Yeah.
So you've got to keep locking the van as you're going up and down. So all these things delayed our departure from the show. So we would leave somewhere like Dundee at 1 o'clock in the morning, and we would drive over 500 miles, you know, to get to Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have in the early days, the only freeways in the UK were the M1, that runs from Sheffield to London, and the M6 that goes from Carlisle to London as well via Birmingham.
Mm.
So I can recall being on that M6 and seeing a London bus driving across in front of me. It's a hallucination, of course, yeah?
Oh, sure.
I remember seeing a giant rabbit, like a 20-foot-tall rabbit, sitting in the middle lane.
Oh, you poor thing.
And I was in the middle lane, and thank God, at 3 o'clock in the morning, the freeways are quite quiet.
Mm.
So I actually drove around the rabbit, although he was never there.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, sleep deprivation is really no joke, is it? And when you're driving, it's just so easy to nod off or whatever. You guys were lucky.
Yeah.
Dear.
Yeah.
Well, that paints a picture of what that tour was like, doesn't it? Giant rabbits and buses that aren't really there.
And remember, something else to plug into this scenario of the tour in 74, there was no such thing as companies like ShowSec or 4DS or these professional security companies. They did not exist.
Well, that was you, right? You were the security.
It was me and Ted, and the venue would give the local rugby club a call, okay, and get six of the guys to come down and sit along the front of the stage, and, you know, listen, guys, we can't really pay you, but you can drink whatever you want, you know?
Yeah.
So if we had an opening act, by the time we got on, these guys have all had, you know, 2 or 3 litres of beer, so they're really not that sharp.
Yeah.
In fact, in one of the photographs that I sent you, you'll see that. That was in a, you'll see me standing at the back of the stage on the left of the photograph, okay?
Yeah.
I'm just looking now. I think maybe, yeah, Woody is actually playing a mandolin there.
Okay.
He's playing, yes, Woody's playing a mandolin and Eric's playing a violin. And I think that was a song. That was a song by a band, now, you go with me here for a minute. You can check this later. I think the band was called East of Eden. In fact, I've got my computer in front of me, so as we're talking, I'll pop it. The band was called East of Eden, and they had a hit called Jigga Jig.
Jigga
Jig. And I am sure that's the song the lads were playing there.
Oh, wow.
It was called Jigga Jig.
Cool.
As we talk very quickly, I'm just going to put this band, East of Eden,
yeah, go
into my search box. east of Eden, okay?
Mm.
East of Eden rock band, here we go. And it was called Jigga Jig.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, but that's cool.
The top 10 hit in 1970 with the band.
That's amazing.
Jigga Jig. And you know what the oddest thing is?
Mm.
On the Wikipedia feed, okay, the guy in the middle of the band, I've just seen this now, has got a passing resemblance to Nobby Clark.
Is that right?
Kind of resemblance. See what you think when you look back.
Yeah, we'll add that picture to the video so people can see what you're
saying.
So, yeah, we'll add it so you can see it. That's incredible.
So this band was called, as I say, this band was called East of Eden. So that's what we were playing at the time. But in that picture, and let you'll see, because it was an instrumental song, right? There was no vocals in it.
Mm.
That's why in that picture, Leslie's standing upstage right with a tambourine in his hand.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And in those days, you didn't mix the sound. You didn't mix sound from out in the hall. You mixed it from the side of the stage. So I am standing there at the side of the stage, controlling the stage sound.
Mixing, bouncing, you do it all. Driving, you do it all, Jake. And we'll get to what else you do later.
By the way, is a gig in a place called Cleethorpes in England on the East Coast.
Hmm.
And that was the Cleethorpes Winter Gardens.
Now, I want to get back to, like, you know, the security. Are the girls at this point jumping on the stage and trying to grab them and being thrown off, or has that not happened yet?
Oh no, that's absolutely happening.
I kind of thought it was.
The other photograph that I sent you, you'll see there's a bouncer standing almost behind Leslie on the stage beside Derek. Did you see that?
Yes, I see that picture.
Yeah,
you can see
that standing over on the left as well, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but you know, nowadays you'd never let anybody on your stage.
Oh, never.
But these guys needed to be on the stage because of these kids coming up on the stage. I mean, look, there's a perfect example. There's two guys down the front are meant to be helping with security, okay? They've both got their shirts off because obviously there's no air conditioning in these venues, right?
Yeah.
In fact, there's four security guys, four local lads. Two have got their shirts off and two have got black shirts over on the right, okay?
Yeah.
What are three of those four guys doing? They're watching the band. They're not watching the band.
That's so funny. Well, like you said, you know, a couple of drinks and, you know, a couple of drinks in, they're not too focused. That's funny.
Yeah.
All right, so now we're coming into 75. Bye Bye Baby hits number one. They start the TV series Shang-A-Lang. Were you involved in that?
Yes, we did that in Manchester at Granada Studios, mm-hmm. Granada TV Studios. And what we did, I think it was a total of about 12 or 13 shows. We did it in 4 weeks because we were gigging.
That's
so what we did is, I think Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we went to Manchester and recorded the three shows. Went off and did gigs, came back again. I mean, I can remember coming up from Taunton in Somerset, I think, having played the show on the Sunday night, driving all during the night to get the equipment there for Monday morning, and then falling asleep in the producer's office in Granada TV, myself and Ted, like, asleep on the floor in his office. We were that fried.
Mm.
Wow. That's a grueling schedule when you think about it. Doing, you know, several shows, and then you have to turn right around and tape three TV shows. That was a lot.
That was mad. Now, also, I can remember from there, at that time, Granada TV Studios was where they recorded the most famous British soap called Coronation Street.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that.
They were quite short of dressing rooms, okay, because that was filming every day. So, I think maybe they had the Monday off. So, they were still short of dressings there. So, we ended up, I think Eric ended up in one of the wardrobe rooms. All the boys, they were all in the same dressing. They ended up in one of the wardrobe rooms, okay?
Mm.
So, now there was a famous actress, her name was Violet Carson. She's no longer with us. She started in the early days. Her name was Ina Sharples. The British, anyone in our demographic will remember this lady.
Mm-hmm.
And she used to go drinking to the local pub in Coronation Street. with her friend, oh, what was her friend's name? Minnie Caldwell. Minnie Caldwell, okay? But in this dressing room, they had all this old clothes and they had these underwear. Eric found this big pair of knickers, okay, that he figured must have belonged to Ina Sharples or Minnie Caldwell.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
So I think Eric was in one dressing room with Woody, and Derek and Alan and Eric were in the next dressing room. So Eric put the knickers on, right, ran into the corridor just to knock on the next dressing room door to let the guys go, look, I've got Ina Sharples knickers on. Woody locked the dressing room door. So he was in the corridor for about 3 or 4 minutes with his famous actress's lacy knickers on. But thankfully, nobody came down the corridor. Funny as hell.
Oh, my God. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, he must have been panicking.
But that was manic because even in the TV studio, the kids would not stay in their seats. Now, there is some film somewhere, possibly on YouTube, of it just all gone magically wrong in that TV studio. They'd start the song, and you know, you'd only be maybe 60 or 100 kids in the TV studio, just enough to give an atmosphere. It was a small studio. And the kids would be up on a gantry in seats. But, you know, it just took one or two kids to be brave enough to leap the gantry and head for the stage, and the rest just followed them, you know?
Oh, wow.
And, you know, drums got knocked over, and we had to stop. Get them all, and it got to the point where they said, look, this happens once more, we're going to have to film it without an audience, you know?
But that was the
level of hysteria we were dealing with regularly.
Yeah, that actually happened. A friend of ours, Gail, she did a podcast a few weeks ago, and she would go to the Granada because she was from Manchester. And she said that the Christmas special that they did, it was filmed without an audience, and then they brought the audience in to watch it, but they were watching it as it already taped. In other words, they were watching a televised version of it just so they could get the crowd reaction. And even with them not being there, it was crazy.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Well, I think the presenter's name, I think her name was Aisha Bruff. Aisha, I think she was an Indian lady, Aisha Bruff.
She was the presenter of the show?
Yeah, the presenter of Shangalang. I think I don't know why that name suddenly comes to me.
Well, those
are manic. And in fact, on a couple of occasions on that Monday to Wednesday period where we did the three shows, because the band were in such demand, We would go off, if it worked out, we'd go off on the Monday afternoon and go do a show in Liverpool, you know, and then come back the next day ready to do another recording at the Granada
TV. Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's like you couldn't get a night off, could you?
No.
Yeah. All right. Well, so also in 75, the second album drops, Once Upon a Star. And there's something very special I want you to tell us about. Tell us about the special thank you on that sleeve for someone called Diddle Diddle.
That album was recorded in Oxfordshire at an old school that had been converted into studios in a place, a lovely place in Oxfordshire called Chipping Norton. And there was a kitchen there within the studio complex, but, you know, these weren't the days where you had a chef standing by and all those sort of things, you know. And the guys were putting in long hours. So Phil Wayman was the producer. The guys and Phil were putting in some long hours. There was accommodation with it as well. They converted the school thing. So, and I think because of the level of hysteria surrounding the band, they thought if they bring in more staff to do it, and it's younger kids, they'll just get pestered, you know. Even, you know, 22, 23-year-old women are still going to be pretty excited at the prospect. So I said, listen, why don't I just make some basic dinner every night? Because remember, I'd been at hotel management school for 2 years before I went to the hotel where I was a disc jockey, okay? So I spent 2 years at a college in Edinburgh called Napier College. It's now called Napier University. And I passed exams for restaurant practice and also for cooking. So each night, I mean, it wasn't up to much. I would just go and get a load of pasta and chicken, and I would cook up these things for these guys. And you see, the thing is, they couldn't go out and even Chipping Norton. Such was a level of high hysteria. They could not go anywhere, you know. And we didn't have we didn't have personal security in those days, you know. That was still something that was far off. It just, you know, you got security at the venues, and basically I had to look after them when we were out in public. So, you know, they just wanted to lock themselves into those studios. And so every night I would just cook up, you know, just a whole load of pasta and chicken, or, you know, I would do fish, or, you know. And of course, being Scottish, occasionally they would just send me out to the local fish and chip shop.
Oh, yeah.
And I would come back with, you know, armfuls of what we call fish suppers, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where the, so because, you know, a lot of early evenings had come down to the kitchen, go, what are you making tonight? And I'd be working away, getting something together. And so when the album came out, they credited me as Jake Diddle Diddle. I think because I always had a wooden spoon in my
Oh, I love it. You know,
fortune, eh?
Quite the Renaissance man. They were very lucky to have you, that's for sure. I mean, you really did it all, you know. Well, you had no choice, but you had to.
It was somewhere to be, it was something to see.
Hmm.
But, you know, let me tell you that there's nothing more exciting. I mean, it is an exciting business, although it's hard work and long hours, as you know. But to be with, there's a lot of guys I've worked with over the years, or many artists, that very few have experienced what I did, was joining a local band that within a couple of years goes stratospheric, you know?
Yeah.
So you're there on the whole ascent. You are there watching this whole thing develop and just shoot towards the stars, no pun intended, on that album cover.
Yeah.
But then there's nothing worse than being on the downside.
Oh, I bet.
Absolutely.
And that comes later.
Yeah, that will come later.
Yeah.
Do you remember much about the Mallory Park incident? Were you there?
Mallory Park.
Was that when they were in the boat in the middle of the trying to get to an island?
Actually, if that came after the recording of Once Upon a Star, probably not. Because that's when I had a difference of opinion.
Okay.
I think the guys were going to take a break after the album, and obviously there was a big tour coming off at the end, towards the end of 1974, starting, say, in October.
Mm-hmm.
The guys were going off, and I felt I should be paid for the time they were taking off, or at least paid part of my salary. And Tam Payton didn't think this was the right thing to do.
Oh.
And I'd seen a very odd thing that rarely happens, but they'd advertised for a band called Jethro Tull in a big music publication at the time called Melody Maker. And I'd written away, and I'd called the number, etc., and they'd asked me to come to London for an interview. And I got the opportunity of the job. And at that point, I mean, remember, I was fried, you know, and you know what it's like when you're fried?
Oh, yeah.
You're dealing with a full deck, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was fried. And I just thought, you know what, these guys are number six in the charts. Okay, they doubled my wages and a little bit more. Now I was on £30. But, you know, I was doing everything.
Right.
And I just thought, oof, you know, and by that time, that was 2 years I'd had of it, you know.
That's a long time.
And it's a long time when you're going at that rate and you're dealing with the way things were back then. And remember, no mobile phones, no computers,
right.
Nothing like that.
No
at
Google
all.
Maps, right. Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So obviously you must have gotten the job with Jethro Tull, and took it.
I did. Yes, I did.
All right. Well, then.
Was it hard for you to leave the Rollers?
It was. I don't think it's something I wanted to do, but then again, as I say, you know, I was not in the right frame of mind.
Sure.
I mean, you know, I don't know, I could probably only talk to Woody about it back then. I don't know if he'd remember, because over the period in that band, listen, this life on the road is about getting along with people that you wouldn't say hello to in the street normally, you know?
Absolutely.
That's what it's about. People in close confines, working 16 hours a day, you just learn to get along. But that doesn't mean that obviously you don't gravitate towards certain people that you have more of a relationship with for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, like a connection.
So for me in that band, it was obviously, Alan and Nobby and John Devine, I just, because they were the sort of older guys, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Eric was his own thing, and Eric never, is it fair to say, would Eric mind me saying, it wasn't always rosy in the park between him and Leslie, you know?
Yeah, sure. That's pretty common knowledge.
Woody was young. Woody was young, a good musician for his age, but he was young, inexperienced, you know, so I caught sort of, you know, and Derek was the quieter of the two brothers. I mean, you know, in that first year I was with that band, you know, I mean, Alan was a bit of a party animal, and Derek was a stay-at-home type of guy. Mm. So the days would go by where those guys never spoke to each other, you know?
Yeah.
Sure.
And it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't tension. They were just different guys, you know?
Yeah.
So I was more of an Alan, John Devine, Nobby Clark sort of guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I got along with them fine, but, you know, there was always that underlying sort of minor friction thing with Eric and Leslie, you know? And I think, you know, Eric was more concerned about the band as a whole, generally, because he'd been there a couple of years before Les showed up, or at least a year. Mm-hmm. Whereas Les had his own agenda, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, that's kind of a common theme as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
it's been amazing hearing your stories where, you know, you're telling us a part of Roller history that we really don't know much about at all. So this perspective has been just amazing to hear.
Yeah, and you know, we're not done yet. We're gonna close for today, but we're gonna have part two because, you know, spoiler alert, you do come back in 1977. So we want to talk about that with you. Will you come back and talk to us?
Yeah, I'm just gonna go get a stiff drink before that starts.
All right. Thank you, Jake. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, as always, our friends and listeners. We hope you enjoyed part one of our session with Jake as much as we did. He is a great storyteller, don't you think? Don't forget to tune in next week for part two, when Jake rejoins the Bay City Rollers in the capacity of their tour manager. Until then, we hope you will check out our previous podcasts if you haven't already done so. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.